Good morning, everybody. We are going to start our conversations with a discussion on IBER reform phase two. I give the floor to Rihanna or Fernando? Fernando.
Good morning, everyone. So with the conclusion of phase one of the IBER project, at the last meeting, we discussed the preliminary scope of phase two and agreed to start with classification and measurement, as any decisions the board makes in this regard could affect other potential phase two issues. This discussion will focus on two papers. Agenda paper 14A, which covers the accounting implications for modifications that are not substantial, i.e. those that would not result in derecognition. And agenda paper 14B, which covers modifications that result in derecognition and the consequential implications when a new financial instrument is recognized. So I will start with agenda paper 14A, and then Dira will take us through agenda paper 14B. The issues analyzed in agenda paper 14A are all related, and the staff considered the recommendations as a package in this paper. We therefore only have one question for the board at the end of the paper, but to ensure that we obtain as much feedback as possible from the board members, I'll tee up the paper in two parts, and then I'll hand over to the board for discussion at the end of each part. Considering the requests made by stakeholders to provide relief from assessing each individual contract to determine whether a modification results in derecognition, the staff considered that in order to appropriately scope any such relief, it would be necessary to ensure that substantial modifications would not be hidden under the cover of IBER reform. Therefore, the staff considered the analysis should first focus on modifications, on what is modification in accordance with IFRS 9, and then secondly, the discussion should focus on which modifications are considered substantial. So regarding the first question, in paragraphs 13 to 15, we discuss what's a modification of a financial instrument. More specifically, in paragraph 14, we acknowledge that IFRS 9 uses slightly different wording to refer to modifications of financial assets and financial liabilities. However, the staff believe that in both cases, IFRS 9 refers to changes in contractual terms or cash flows of a financial instrument in a way that was not originally intended when entering into that contract. Therefore, in paragraph 15 of the paper, we recommend that IFRS 9 should be amended to clarify that even in the absence of an amendment to the contractual terms of a financial instrument, a change in the basis for determining the contractual cash flows that alters what was originally anticipated constitutes a modification under IFRS 9. Then moving on to the second question related to how to determine whether a modification is substantial, in paragraphs 16 to 24 of the paper, we discuss how to determine whether a modification is substantial. And more specifically, in paragraph 20, we note that when applying the 10% test and the difference is lower than 10%, entities would still look at other factors for the purpose of assessing whether a modification is substantial. However, IFRS 9 does not provide specific guidance about when modifications to financial assets and liabilities might be substantial from a qualitative perspective. So in this context, paragraphs 21 to 23 of the paper recommend that IFRS 9 should be amended to provide examples of modifications that are considered substantial and modifications that are not considered substantial from a qualitative perspective. At this point, I'll pause here to see whether the board members have any comments or views to share on these two questions.
Fernando, just a factual question. Do we have any idea of the possible prevalence of substantial modifications in this process?
It's difficult to say at this stage,
I understand.
Based on what we've heard, if we think about a simple replacement of IBOR with a new benchmark, it shouldn't be a substantial modification because it's just a replacement of a benchmark for a new one on an economically equivalent basis.
Yes.
So it's more a continuation.
It is in itself easy to do.
Yes.
Yes.
For that, if that's the only change we're making.
Yes.
But I think what we just want to make sure is that we don't mix other changes that are being made to the contract, and where people are reassessing the credit risk, or they, you know, extending the loan, or they change the other terms of the contract, that is not also included in this IBOR change, which is, you know, rolled up into a quite an easy accounting, and we don't hide the economic effects of those other modifications. That's why we think it's important to first say what would be what would be significant or substantial, so that we can appropriately scope the scope of changes that would not be substantial, and that we could look for a practical expedient or some kind of relief.
Yeah. But the existing standards as they are would not would not make this assessment sufficiently possible.
I can comment.
Huh?
Do you want me to comment on that?
Yeah. So.
Firstly, going back to your first question, I think the objective of what's going on with the IBOR reforms around the world is to make sure that they're not substantial modifications. So I think that's the sort of plan in terms of how they're setting the new rates. But the point that Rhianna's making correctly is that the challenge is that when you're dealing with counterparties to an existing transaction, as soon as you open a document, you open a negotiation, and other things can get done at the same time. And so that's what we're trying to manage. In terms of your second question, in terms of would the standards deal with it at the moment?
Because we have rules for this already.
No? We do have requirements for this. I think that if you applied the requirements today, that often you could, assuming you haven't changed anything other than just the base rate, you probably could conclude that there hasn't been a substantial modification, would be my assessment. However, I think the challenge is that the accounting that then results is not very clear. And so it's a combination of the clarification of how to think about a substantial modification, and also the second recommendation in the paper, which is to say then just treat it like an update of a floating rate, which doesn't exist at the moment, which is really, I think, the more important part of what's proposed. Can I? But on the first part of the paper, two comments. Firstly, I think that it's a good opportunity to improve the wording that exists in IFRS 9, because I think it has to be the case that a modification includes where you've kept the same name but the mechanics have changed, because otherwise you could keep the name and change what it means and you're going to, you know, get an accounting which wouldn't reflect the economics. But we do have different wording in two different places, so I think it's a good opportunity to clarify. So I would agree with that. In terms of the proposals on providing some more colour around when a modification would be considered substantial or not, I think the important thing here is that I think we don't necessarily have to do that to do the rest of what's proposed in the paper. So I'm not sure that it's an essential part. Mm-hmm. Personally, I think it's probably a helpful thing to do, because we have had quite a few requests over the years for more guidance on what is a modification and what's not a modification, particularly because it's important to determine how to apply the expected credit loss model to things, because it has a profound difference whether a modification is a resulting in you going back to a new instrument in stage one or not. And people have told us that's hard to do based on the amount of information that's in there. I think I would agree with what you've got as your proposals here. The only suggestion I'd have on the wording would be in 22D to make it clear. I think that we would say that a modification in the other direction would also be a substantial modification. So if you introduce something that causes you to be SPPI or not to meet SPPI, I think that would be symmetrical. I think it's worth proposing this. But I think we should be open if people are concerned that this is too much change to introduce now as part of these amendments, because I think we need to be careful to keep as focused as possible in these amendments to deal with this issue. And actually, we could make a huge project just out of this part of it if we really were minded to do that. And in the past, the Interpretations Committee was asked about this and they said don't do it because it's a big job. We're sort of tinkering at the edges by giving a few more hints. It's not a comprehensive review. So I think the balance is right, but I think we need to keep in our mind that if people wrote back to us, if we were to propose this and said don't do it now, we should think about you know, not needing to proceed with this, even if we continued with the rest of the package.
Mary?
A couple of things. I agree with your proposal to say explicitly that modifications include a change in the underlying calculation, even if there's another change in the name. I do want us to think in terms of, I found the phrase, I think it's paragraph 14, you're changing the terms in a way that was not originally intended. that concept of what was originally intended, that we might have to reach back to some of our thinking in phase one. And let me explain a bit what I'm talking about, which is in phase one, we said that if you have a term in the contract that says, hey, there's all this IBOR reform going on, at some point we might need to change your reference rate from the current IBOR, LIBOR or whatever, to its replacement rate, and we'll make appropriate adjustments. I think in phase one we say that doesn't resolve the uncertainty about the timing and amount of the change, and therefore we have to provide relief, blah, blah, blah. If I just look at the words in paragraph 14 of change it in a way that was not originally intended, if you just had that same high level, we might have to change your rate. Somebody could say, well, that change is a change that was intended when the IBOR reform comes along. But if it is so high level, I think I want to test whether when it comes along you actually make that replacement for the current IBOR to whatever the new rate is, to test the calculation of the new rate against the existing rate and see if it is the economic equivalent or not. And so I don't want a very high-level statement in the contract. That's something I'm struggling with in this area.
Can I just say, you agree with the point that if you change the basis on which you calculate your underlying cash flows, that if that changes, even though the contract doesn't change, that is a modification.
Yes, right? So let's call it IBID.
Yeah?
IBID is the rate. And it stays named IBID, but we fundamentally change how you calculate it. So it is instead of an offer rate, it's an actual rate. Yes, I think that should be tested as a...
I think, to your point, I understand that, if you've got a fallback clause in the contract which just says at some point we might replace your rate with another rate.
Yeah.
And in phase one we said, well, that means there's still uncertainty and so you get to assume that nothing has happened. When that clause now gets triggered and you now decide, okay, this is going to be the rate and this is mm-hmm. going to be the spread, I think I would still view that as not a modification because the contract already provided for it, so it's like an option or something that gets triggered mm-hmm. at the beginning. But I think when we look at the follow-on accounting from that, I wonder whether, because in the second part of the paper when we talk about even those changes, like you've just said, it's not a modification. What would be the best accounting for that? And I wonder if we shouldn't then just try to link those kind of changes and make sure they also fall under the practical expedient instead of doing something different for them.
I don't want to automatically put them in the practical expedient. What I want to do is consider whether they should be within the practical expedient. Because let's say I had that... I can see I'm freaking out, Sue, with what I'm saying here, but and I'm not. It's not that I am. It must be called a modification, but what I'm trying to get to is when we have such a high level statement in a contract, I don't want that to provide a safe harbor for any. So let's say it comes time to replace the rate that I have with a new rate. And instead of giving an economically equivalent rate, I end up negotiating something that is a very significant change. I don't want somebody to say, well, that's just what was originally contemplated in the contract, so I don't have to consider it in terms of what the effect is and just automatically treat it as the same way I would treat, let's say, a change in a variable rate, because the benchmark itself has moved. And that's what I'm struggling with here. It isn't that it must be called a modification.
I will help you.
Well, you should explain why I'm wrong.
Well,
No.
I guess it's more, first, can you talk about the concern before you talk about how we label it and channel it into the analysis?
To build on what Rihanna said.
Yeah.
I think modifications are special because modifications are saying, is this the same financial instrument I had yesterday? Mm-hmm. That's the basis of these modification paragraphs. So you can decide whether you can treat it as the same instrument or whether you say, actually, even though the counterparties are the same and you started with the same contract and you tinkered with a few terms, mm-hmm. really you've entered into a new financial instrument, and that's what the modification paragraphs are about. And all through our literature, we have to deal with this. So we've got modification language in 9, we've got modification language in 16, we've got modification in 17, probably elsewhere.
15.
And in all of those cases, well, I don't know about 15, but and certainly in 9, 16, and 17, we make a very clear distinction between was something sitting latent in the contract right from the start that you didn't know what was going to happen with it, or was something introduced as a new paragraph or clause into the contract later on, which means the question of whether it's a new instrument or not arises. And that's a pretty fundamental distinction. So I think if we start saying, well, actually, it was in the contract, but let's think about, you know, how broad, narrow, et cetera, it is, I think that would be a really fundamental change, which to me scares me in the scope of a narrow scope project. Having also, just and this will probably, the market will hate this, but if you've got a paragraph in your clause in your FI contract which says that this is the interest rate today, but by the way, I can set this as any other interest rate I can come up with that I'm going to imagine in the future at any point in time, that should not meet solely payments of principal and interest. Because solely payments of principal and interest says, look at your contract and all of the possibilities of cash flows that can arise from that contract that have more than a potential de minimis effect. And if those don't just look like simple principal and interest, that's not SPPI. Mm-hmm. So if you've got some wacky clause in there that's completely open, I don't think you're an SPPI even to start with, so I don't think that that should happen. But I do agree with you that if you did have a clause already in the contract which was very generic and it basically says, if I need to change the rate, I will change the rate. Let's assume for a moment you've got through SPPI somehow. That we probably do need to think about whether the change that eventuates from that clause is a benign change or not. And if it is a benign change, we probably want them to be able to do what's in this paper. So I think your point is a fair one, but I wouldn't say it needs to be dealt with in the modification paragraph.
I wanted to raise it now because it seemed in some ways related to this. We don't change the name, but we do change the calculation thing. But I don't. I'm less concerned about how we channel it into the analysis as long as we do channel it in, rather than saying as long as it was in the contract, you don't have to think about it, ever again. And that was one thing. The second is, and Fernando, you kind of alluded to this in your tee-up, is that we have, the Interpretation Committee discussions have highlighted some breakage between the discussion of what is a modification when you have a liability versus what is a modification when you have an asset. And if we are intending one set of guidance to apply to, changes that are made because of IBOR for both, whether you're the holder of an asset or the obligor for liability, we maybe want to say, at least for purposes of this test, whether we are saying there's symmetrical assessment. Either say we do or say we don't, but I found the analysis in here seemed to be talking about both assets and liabilities at one time, and sometimes it was referring to statements that were only explicit requirements for liabilities. And I think we need to be careful about that.
I think we have to be careful about symmetry as well, because I think there's a historical reason for the difference between the two, and that's because you've got the impairment mechanics happening on the asset side, so you can have more tinkering going on because and an interaction with impairment, which is why the test has always been less black and white for assets than it is for liabilities.
But then we may have to step through this when we get to the more detailed drafting separately for assets and liabilities, because doing it combined had inferences for me that I wasn't... I wanted to be sure we were careful about.
Is your concern just around the 10% test?
Or is it about the fact that for liabilities we talk about changes in terms and for assets we talk about changes in contractual cash flows?
It was the former rather than the latter, the 10% test.
Yeah. And I think it is because of the fact that the 10% test is mentioned specifically in the context of liabilities, it doesn't quite make sense in on an asset side, but we do have an IFRIC agenda decision which said, well, you know, you can apply it by analogy. If it's not a transfer, you can look at that guidance.
Yeah.
But when we went through the paper, we only think about it, we never thought about the 10% test in the context of assets.
That wasn't clear to me. It read to me as if we were talking about it for both.
Well, I think if you read the 2012 IFRIC decision, it says you can do it by energy. So, you know, even if somebody do it today, we can't say they wrong in that sense. But it's more when we talked about the qualitative assessment you have to do, or for assets you have to do a qualitative assessment. For liabilities, if it's less than 10%, you still need to do a qualitative assessment. And it's, I think we were focusing more on that qualitative part rather than the 10% part.
Chung Wu.
I agree with Steph's proposal and recommendation. But one thing I have a concern, like some other board members have suggested, in the kind of scope of that exceptions apply to, now that may I have some concern. Because, you know, if you see the paragraph 6, you said there are a number of ways and some kind of modifications of the contract after this reform is, introduced in the system. So you listed the A, B, and C, and D. Later on, the paragraph 43 or 44, you classified these various ways into two categories. One is there are some change that related to reform, so that kind of a change can be get some kind, enjoy that this kind of a exception to the modification requirement, but others cannot enjoy this exception. So it seems to me, in paragraph 6, you suggest all kind of a variety of ways to, you know, tackle with this kind of reform, but all of a sudden in later. So I just wonder how to classify these all kind of a combination of changes into these two categories.
This is related to the second part of the paper, so we might we can.
We'll come back to that point, but I think just to answer your question on paragraph 6, that. It's sort of just, you know, we just provided background in saying that when we got feedback on this point and when people raised the question around modifications and derecognition in the comment letter on phase one, they gave us examples of things that could happen. And we've had discussions with some stakeholders, and these are the, you know, some of the examples of what could happen. So this is just a very broad case of saying, well, you know, when people are going to open the contracts, they're going to make changes, they're going to renegotiate the benchmark rate. These are things they could change, but we unpack these then later in the paper to distinguish them between what we mean. And so I think paragraph 6 is just sort of setting the scene and saying, well, these are the changes, and that's why we thought we need to consider it step by step, because it's such a wide range of changes.
Daryl. So Sue was speaking the first time around. I eventually put down my nameplate because I think she had covered what I had been concerned about. But I just want to make sure, because I then wasn't too sure I understood what your response was going to be to it, Rihanna. I think you said, yeah.
You should understand that.
So if I understood how Sue was articulating the same concern I had, it was that I agree with your recommendations, I agree with the direction you're taking, but I have a little bit of a concern that they have slightly broader scope than just the thing we're trying to deal with here. And I think Sue was saying that we need to bear in mind at the back of our heads as we go through this process that we may need to narrow that scope down later because of perhaps unintended consequences of them being slightly broader. But I guess my question was just how are we then going to deal with that in the exposure draft we put out? Are we going to explain that there is an alternative way, which is the narrower one, or are we looking to just put out there and just see what we get back? And also we're going to try and see if we can understand through the exposure process whether there are unintended consequences beyond the IBOR reform.
Yes, I think that would be... I mean, we can... I think looking at these two questions, the second one around the examples of what is a substantial modification and what is not completely essential. And so we can address it in that way in the exposure draft and maybe explain in the basis that because normally modifications happen more on a one-to-one basis and it's more an individual basis. And in this case, the banks are going to do batch modifications. They're going to do wholesale, literally, modifications. And so they're going to be inundated with all these things they now have to assess. So even if we take the pure LIBOR changes out, just looking at the other modifications, there could still be quite a lot. And so we could say in the basis that, you know, trying to help entities through this big change and this volume of modifications they have to assess, we've included the examples, but, you know, if there are unintended consequences, those examples itself is not necessarily essential for the rest of the relief we want to give. But I think the clarification on what is a modification, that would be necessary or essential to understand the rest of the...
Okay. And I mean, it's maybe that I'd ask too. So the way that you've worded it in paragraph 15, I think, starts out with the therefore in the light of IBOR reform. But then we propose something that is not linked back to IBOR reform. So it is essentially a slightly broader, it is potentially capturing a slightly broader view of the world as well there. So that's the clarification was useful. So when you were talking about this, you weren't thinking about that specific recommendation. Okay.
Tadeo?
Right. Thank you, Hans. The paper is good. It gives a good idea why phase two is necessary. The examples that we have in paragraph 22 and 23, and what would be and what not be considered a substantial modification, and I believe that substantial modification should be addressed here to understand better why we have to discuss why is necessary to add an exception for IFRS 9 and 39, maybe, because of the IBOR reform. And I think that makes an important interaction with that. Despite the examples are good and helpful, I'm just wondering whether we could add some principles. For example, to highlight that even if the present value it is the same, why they are is considered a substantial modification? It is because actually the risks attached, for example, they have changed. And then you look at the number is the same, present value is the same. The 10% rule doesn't apply, but this is still a significant modification. We are providing examples, they are good, but I'm just wondering whether we could add some principles to this, and then we could get advantage of this modification, not only for the IBOR reform, but for also in the future assessment, what would be the definition of substantial modification.
Yeah, we can definitely work on that principle. We have an example on paragraph 22B that illustrates what you are trying to highlight. When you have an extension of the maturity of a financial instrument, it typically wouldn't affect the present value calculation to give you the same number. So it wouldn't affect the 10% test, for example, but as you said, from a risk perspective, you have, let's say, you could change the maturity from 3 months to 13 years and not have any effect on present values. So we can clarify that in the final document.
Ms. Raza.
I think I understand what the proposals are, and I support that we try to help people go through the assessment in both a practical way but also with rigor as to the economic effect. But I think we have to circumscribe that to the IBOR reform, and I think we have to do that in the exposure draft. Because I agree it would be great to take the opportunity and adjust a guidance that has been identified as in need for improvement. But if we are facing the timing constraint that I understand we're facing, we may want to have a limited comment period. People may have to rely on fast endorsement processes and the like, and we cannot afford in such a time frame to have the full analysis, the full outreach, the full effect analysis that this could have going forward for the usual scope of IFRS 9. And on top of that, we may raise controversy and difficulties and anxieties as to the outcome of this process when we are supposed to help people go through a reform and not, in fact, potentially create what people would see as being problems. So as much as I would like to give us the opportunity to kill two birds with one stone, I would really adopt a very careful attitude so that everything we do, and for example, in choosing a common period, that, you know, we do it having in mind the time frame of this reform and how quick we need to be, and not thinking, oh, but we have also part of our proposals that apply more widely, so how could we be so quick? So I think we have really to remain focused. And unfortunately, I think we have to remain focused.
Okay, Zhao.
Thank you. I generally agree with the staff's direction and the proposal. With regard to the modification of a financial instrument, I think the intention of the staff proposal is try to narrow down the scope, only address the issue arising from the IBOR reform. So I have a suggestion, because when I look at the wording of paragraph 15, we mentioned that address is a change in the of the contractual cash flow are determined, but different people may have different understanding the basis of those contractual cash flow determined. So I would like to, if just the wording, you know, specifically mention that that's the changing of the interest rate benchmark. And secondly, I also hope that, as Sue mentioned, that maybe in some jurisdiction, they just keep the name of the benchmark, benchmark, but actually the calculation methodology also changed. So I still hope that this kind of change of the benchmark also include those, you know, changes of calculation methodology. So this kind of wording also should be included in the recommendation of the amendment to the IFRS 9. Specifically, I mentioned those two cases.
Can I just clarify to make sure I understand? So when we talk in paragraph 15 about what is a modification, we looked at it in the context of IBOR, but I don't think we've meant to say that only a modification in the context of IBOR is. You know, when you change the cash flows, but in other cases, when you modify the cash flows in a contract, that's not a modification. So I think we mean that a modification, as described in IFRS 9, is including when it is the terms and the cash flows. Yes, it's now come to light because of IBOR, but that part of paragraph 15, that recommendation is an overall one. It's not limited to IBOR.
Okay. Oh. Yeah, because originally I think, because you say in light of the IBOR reform, then we make that change. So now I understand actually it's the broader changing to the existing requirements. So whether there are any unexpected consequences because of these changes. Yeah.
But I think what we meant with in the light of IBOR is we became aware that there's now much more modifications where the contract might not be, but the actual calculation, and that's why I think we phrased it that way.
Mary.
Just commenting kind of both on Jean Jao's question and Francois's comment, On the one hand, I agree we have to be very, very careful and disciplined to avoid scope creep. And it will be tempting as we come across things that we know, you know, have come to the interpretation committee or other questions. But I think we cannot say from the outset that we are going to say that everything we do is only going to apply when you are assessing changes made as a result of IBOR reform. I think that's putting an artificial limit, and it will raise questions about things that we may be clarifying. It reminds me very much of the issue we discussed yesterday, IAS 37 and identifying when a contract is onerous. It was the change from IFRS 15 that kind of shone a spotlight on that question. And so we had to go in and look at that question, but we are not limiting that change to saying this only applies when you're looking, you know, when you're looking at an IFRS 15 contract. But I think we do have to be very disciplined. So I think what it means for me is to ask the staff when they're bringing us specific items to have a very clear flag about whether this is expected to come into play only for changes that are likely to, you know, to be made because of IBOR reform, or whether it's a change that might also have kind of ongoing implications. Just flag that so that we're aware of that and can think of it.
On this theme, I think I would be actually happy with the comments that Francoise made in terms of maybe not proposing these more general clarifications on how to think about modifications more generally, because it's broadening the scope of the project, so, and because it can stand alone. So I think that's probably fair. But I do think we should make the clarification in terms of the modifications includes where the words, you know, the names change, but the calculation.
Other way around.
Sorry, where the word hasn't changed, but the calculation has changed. Because I think it's really important, and I think it is, we can present it as a change to the standard, as a clarification, because we do have an inconsistency in wording between the financial assets and the financial liabilities. I think it's a good opportunity to do that, and I think that's important beyond the scope of IBOR. Now, people might, I know that I've had some conversations with people who have freaked out when I've said that, but I think it is important, and it doesn't mean that because the calculation changes, you're necessarily going to have a derecognition type event. It just means you need to think about it, right? So you could have changes in, you know, the number of banks that are consulted or some smallish change in the calculation. It doesn't mean that you've got, you know, a dramatic moment, but it means that you do need to be thinking about it. And I think that's all that we're intending to do. But, yeah, I'd be happy not to proceed with these other clarifications in the interest of time.
Okay.
Sorry, but I do think it would be helpful somewhere to mention, because I think one useful thing that did come from the Interpretation Committee discussions on financial assets that may not be as visible as it could be, is that they said two things in that agenda decision, and everybody listens to one and not the other. They said two things. One is you may analogise to the 10% test, but they also said you need to decide whether or not you think it's an expiry, and that's the more qualitative thing. Is it, does it look so different that it's really the case that the old thing's expired and the new thing has been created? And I don't think that necessarily should be elevated to the front, because that's too comprehensive a change, but I think a reminder of that agenda decision in the basis or something at least gives somebody an extra anchor to think about in the modification thinking.
Okay.
So in paragraphs 25 to 42 of the paper, we discuss modifications related to the reform as being those that will result in changes to the interest rate benchmark on an economically equivalent basis. In other words, there would be no significant value transfer between parties to the contract. As discussed in paragraph 31, without any amendments to IFRS 9, entities would have to account for a change to the interest rate benchmark as a modification, with any resulting gain or loss recognized in P&L as required by paragraph 543 of IFRS 9. In other words, such modifications would not qualify for paragraph B, 545 of IFRS 9. However, in paragraph 36 of the paper, we note that applying paragraph B, 545 to modifications related to the reform would provide more useful information to users of financial statements, as this would better reflect the economics of IBOR replacement on an economically equivalent basis. This would also significantly reduce the operational burden on preparers, as they would account for such modifications as an update to the effective interest rate in the same way as they do today. Therefore, in paragraphs 37 to 40 of the paper, we recommend that IFRS 9 should be amended to provide a practical expedient which would allow entities to apply paragraph B545 to account for modifications related to the reform. Examples of modifications related to the reform are discussed in paragraph 39, and examples not related to the reform are discussed in paragraph 40 of the paper. And finally, assuming the board agrees with providing a practical expedient, in paragraph 45, we further recommend that IFRS 9 should be amended to clarify the order in which such modifications should be accounted for. More specifically, an entity should first apply the practical expedient to modifications related to the reform, and then apply current IFRS 9 requirements to account for modifications that are not related to the reform, i.e. entities would determine whether such modifications are substantial or not, and account for it as required by IFRS 9 today. So I will now pause here to see whether the board members have any comments or views on these staff recommendations. And just a clarification back to your point, Shangu, regarding the examples that we provide in paragraph 39 and 40. We first try to elaborate the principle about modifications related to the reform. We say that these type of modification are those that are done on an economically equivalent basis. And then the examples are more to guide preparers when applying this concept. So the list of examples, they are not exhaustive, but there are some examples that we saw that are those that would be more frequent in practice. So with that, I'd like to hand over to the board.
Can I just ask to make sure my understanding of the flowchart in paragraph 42? In the beginning of the this paragraph, this flowchart, the question is, if the change amendment is a modification, but when I look at the second boxes of two, it starts talking about if the case practical expedient does not apply and does apply. So I'm just wondering, the starting point of this flowchart is whether the modifications are related to the reform or not. And then reform is, then the modification is, in the case, the modification is related to the reform, and then the practical experiment will be applicable or should be applied.
Yeah. So I think the first box is asking whether it is a modification, so it's back to the first part of the paper. Is it a modification or not? If it is a modification, then the second step is to assess whether it is related to the reform, mm-hmm. which means does the practical expedient apply or not? So if the practical expedient applied, then entities would apply a paragraph B545, which is just an update of the effective interest rate. But if it is not related to the reform, it yes. means that the practical expedient does not apply, and then entities would apply IFRS 9 requirements as usual. So
I'm just wondering, there is no second question about whether the modifications are related to the reform or not within this project. So I'm a little bit confused.
The practical expedient is code for
the modifications related to the reform, yes.
But so
I think where we say if the practical expedient does not apply, we mean the modifications are not related to the reform.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. So that's the first question, combined.
Yeah.
Okay. And the second question is, when the timing of the initial application of the
the modification related to the reform. When is the initial timing to apply this practical expedient? Is anything, any accounting implication we need to look up?
Well, I think the reason we call it a practical expedient is because you sort of just continue to do what you have been for those modifications that are related to reform. You just update your EIR like you would have done for your floating rate instrument in any case, and so there's nothing special you have to do. There's no P&L impact in that case because you just update your EIR and prospectively, so there's no catch-up adjustment. And so I think that's why for the practical expedient, there's no implication of doing it. But there's an implication if you don't do it.
It's also a practical expedient in the sense that you don't have to do, for example, the 10% test, right?
Yes.
If you're in this, you sort of can quickly say, okay, it's in this bucket.
Yeah, but there's no impact on it.
But we haven't decided that yet.
Well, no, but in terms of what we are saying in the paper is if you apply the practical expedient, which is to apply the EIR accounting, then there is no immediate impact at that date. If you don't agree with that, then yes, of course there's going to be an impact, but, I'm optimistic, yeah.
I just wonder when we jump in this flowchart, it's just a question. It is a timing, the starting point to consider this practical experiment. Are we clear about that?
Well, it has to come from replacement of IBOR.
Yeah.
So it's maybe the line between phase one and phase two.
I think to an extent it is linked to that. But, if we look at what is a modification and what we've discussed previously in terms of the modification, which could be a change in the cash flows. And so I think this, typically this would apply when they actually now change, and so there is no uncertainty. But I think we need to come back to this because depending on what we decide today will have implications for the next paper, which is on hedge accounting, and what we decide there will have implications on the end of relief for phase one and how that interacts with things we decide now.
But if your question, Rika, is, and I might be reading too much into it, but if the question is related to do you start applying this flowchart when your relief ends from phase one, mm-hmm. I don't think the answer is necessarily yes. Mm-hmm. I think phase two is triggered by when you're actually making changes to your contracts.
Right.
Yeah. Which is a slightly different thing. Yeah,
when you do modifications.
Yeah.
Yes, so there might be some overlap
when you make a modification.
Martin.
I want to double check. Your proposal is if you do then the change of the contract, which has then both elements. One is maybe to reset it to the new benchmark interest rate, but do also other changes. And then you're saying, okay, but then do the accounting first, do the relief regarding to the benchmark reform, because that would trigger that you have a new effective interest rate. And then do the rest, and that helps you, because then you can also, if you have a modification which is not substantive, then you have the effective interest rate which is a new benchmark reform. Is that the rationale? That,
yes.
Because otherwise you would get the old, which maybe will disappear. I think I understood that. But I don't understand if the modification is substantial, and if you have to derecognize, why you should first do the benchmark reform? And that is, I have not understood. So. Because when if you overall is a substantial modification, I think you then calculate and do new stuff, or is it kind of how you then calculate the gain or loss from derecognition? Is that the reason why we're doing
it? You need to do the first step so you've got the right carrying amount before you do the derecognition.
Yes, but if you do the first step, your
carrying amount won't change.
You don't change your carrying amount, so I don't think it makes.
I think it doesn't matter. That is my point, because if you would conclude it is substantial, and then derecognition, you don't have to do first benchmark reform, then you start from you, because you don't have an impact from the first on the carrying value, so there is not any change. Or do I miss something?
Your point is about the order in which you do the assessment of determining whether the other changes are substantial or not, and if they are, then you know, you just de-recognize and carry on.
Exactly. Don't have to do that.
Yeah, and I think we were more thinking about the order of the accounting, so not the assessment itself, but when you have to account for it, what is the order in which you account for it? So in other words, the order in which you do your calculations, because that, I think, makes a difference. We weren't necessarily thinking about the order in which you do the assessment. We can clarify that if necessary, but I think we were more thinking about the mechanics of the accounting and how you calculate your modification gain or loss. It's you know, assuming you've already decided that those other changes are not substantial.
Okay.
Mary?
Okay, first I'm going to make a bid for Dork of the Day Award. Which is following up on Martin's clarification. If you look at the flowchart that follows paragraph 42, I think what he was pointing out is that in the 1, 2, 3, 4th column, that's the top box, recognize the modification gain or loss using the original EIR, that he was pointing out that that box is wrong, that it actually should be modified. Using the modified
yes.
EIR. So that's my bid on Dork of the Day. But The comment, I have three comments that relate to communication points. And the first one is this section talks about modifications related to the reform. And I was a bit troubled that the notion of related to the reform is a very broad characterization. And we just could be communicating and sending signals that make people think that it's a much broader church than it actually is going to be. I think we're trying to capture modifications that are a direct consequence of the reform that achieve economic equivalence. You know, those are the ones we're trying to capture with the practical expedient, because I don't want to send a message that gets people thinking, as long as I can tie this change I'm making to the fact that I had to go and talk to my borrower about benchmark reform, shouldn't it be in there? Wasn't that your intention to capture that as long as it's a reasonable consequence? And I think we should be communicating more clearly that what we're trying to do is identify changes, and I'm not calling modifications, changes that are made to instruments to, you know, that are necessary because of the reform that deliver economic equivalence. And for those, we're trying to provide some practical relief and start talking about it that way. So that's the first suggestion.
Can I just then ask, in paragraph 39, we say that modifications related to the reform are those that result in changes to the interest rate benchmark on which the instrument's contractual cash flows are based on an economically equivalent basis.
That's right, but I think we should just start talking about that right away rather than shorthanding it as modifications relating to the reform. Okay. It's wordier, but if we talk generically about modifications related to the reform, I think we have to, you know, not everybody will read all the way and say, but when they say related to the reform, they're only talking about this slice that delivers economic equivalence. That's why I said this is a communication point, not a technical point, because I think you come down to describing the right population. And the other thing in terms of communication is the sequencing point. It took me a while to realize that it's a point that we address again, you know, we address in many different, I think in several different standards, which is if you have changes, do you look at the significance of the changes and say, as a whole, they're either qualifying or not qualifying for whatever we're testing, or do you take out the piece that's okay and then deal with the residual? And I think the calculation methodology you're specifying via the sequencing guidance is to say, first you pick out the piece that's related to benchmark reform, but you're pulling out the economic equivalent piece,
yeah,
and then you're moving on to deal with the residual. So I think it would be more helpful to clarify, to characterize this, to communicate about it as saying, we're taking the approach of pulling out that economically equivalent piece by saying, here's how you sequence the calculation, so that people know that we've addressed this question of, is it an all or nothing thing, Or is it a pull out the economic equivalent piece in a package that may have more going on? It may be that the only thing you're doing is economic equivalent, then the piece you pull out is the whole thing.
But just to make sure, when you say it's all or nothing, are you talking about the changes to, you know, the changes that are related to the reform on an economically equivalent basis, those changes to the benchmark rates that you need to, you know, because I think the way, maybe it's easier to explain this, the way we, or I at least think about it, is you look at the changes you are making to the benchmark rate and the modifications related to that, so it includes all these repricing things, and you look at those changes as a package and you say, are they economically equivalent? And if they are, then you apply the practical expedient. The other changes, which are changes to the, you know, maybe the credit spread or the term or the maturity or those things, you deal with them separately.
Right. And it's the fact that you're dealing with them separately as opposed to saying, I have this package of changes.
Yes.
Is the package as a whole qualify?
No. And if it pieces. Yes.
You know, and it's just saying split it into pieces. Let me be dangerous and, you know, give an example with IS-32 in the discussion paper, you know, the FICE-DP, where we said if it's not entirely dependent, the whole thing, you know, is no good, as opposed to you pull out the piece that is. That's what I mean about we take different approaches, and I think we should just say that the approach we're taking here is to identify whether there are some or, you know, what portion of it is the economic equivalence and account for it that way, and we do it via the sequencing. It's just, and it's explaining what the significance of the sequencing instruction is.
Okay. Tadeo.
Thank you, Hans. Two points, short one. Just in paragraph 34, and we many times mentioned here, economically equivalent basis, and everybody knows what is economic equivalent basis. But I'm not sure whether if we are going to use these in the modifications, it would be good to define what exactly economically equivalent basis mean. And why I'm asking that is because my second question is, can we have a change caused by the reform, therefore not caused by either part of the contract, that occurred not in an economic equivalent basis, but still gets the practical expedient relief? Can we have a situation, for example, that it's just because the way that the reform was placed, either part of the contract have no control on it, and for any reason, someone may end up saying that, okay, there is a change caused by the reform, but it's not necessarily economically equivalent basis. Can this still apply for this practical expedient?
I would say no, because if there's something in the reform that forces there to be significant value transfer between the parties to the contract, whether they had a hand in it or not, but if there's significant value transfer and it's not on an economically equivalent basis, I think we would, you know, hide the impact of that by allowing the practical expedient to apply. So I think that the key thing, for me at least, in applying the practical expedient, that it is, you know, required or related to the reform in that sense, but it's on an economically equivalent basis, which is what we've been hearing all along about how people apply or how they plan to, for the transition to work is on an, you know, sort of equal basis, and there's no value transfer. But if there is, then I don't think we should hide it or include it in the change to the EIR and therefore not show that impact or the economics of that value transfer. So I would say no.
Okay.
A couple of things, partly in response to some of the other comments that have been raised. So just one question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but in response to Martin's question, if you have a situation where you've got this combination of, you know, the IBOR equivalence thing going on plus something else going on, and you need to work out whether the something else is substantive or substantial, whatever the words are, do you not need to know what rate to use to do that assessment? Because part of it might be the 10% test. So that could be a situation where I think you may end up derecognizing, but you still need to know what order to do it in, so you can think about the 10% test the right way. I'll just leave that with you, but I think it might still matter. But on Mary's geek of the day point, I'm going to try. Oh, dork. I don't like that. Geek's better. I think it is helpful because I got a little bit confused. It made sense to me when I reread the paper, but when I first read it, this idea of we're thinking about it in pieces, I think it's worth actually saying that out loud because I think it just helps understand the flow chart, because I got it in my head you were either going down one part of the flow chart or the other, but actually you could be going down different parts of the flow chart for one transaction because of the two things going on together. So I think it might just help with communication. But on her point about IBOR reform and not just saying that it results from the reform, and I know these words like directly related and things are difficult, which is probably why that wasn't your initial proposal, but I think we need to think carefully about the wording, because if I look at paragraph 39, and I know this isn't the draft, but based on the words we've got at the moment, we say it's related to the reform and would include. So this isn't a closed population. So we do have some, we could have somebody coming along and saying, well, it's not in the list, but it does relate to the reform, so therefore I'm going to tick the box and decide I can apply it. Similarly, I think we need to be careful in paragraph 40 that I think we're saying we're not going to treat these as being related to the reform.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment it says entities could also modify other terms which are not related to the reform. They might say, well, actually, it does relate to the reform. I think we're basically deeming that these are not considered to be related to the reform, and I think we need to just be careful with the drafting to be... We're not going to be able to have exhaustive lists because we're not going to cover everything, which is why I think Mary's point is important, because we need to be clear that it needs to really directly come from this reform and be sort of necessary because of the reform. And we've tried to list the things we could think of, but it's not a closed list. Yeah. But we do need to be careful that it is, we mean pretty, you know, a narrowish set. And then my final question is, because everybody's going to ask us, how does this compare with what the FASB have proposed? Based on when I had a quick read, similar in structure, at least, in the way that we've sort of said, you know, you go down a special path because of the reform.
Yeah, so I think what we've... the way we set it out is that it is similar to the outcome you would get under the FASB's proposals as we understand it, in the sense that if you are making changes to the benchmark rate and the related terms in the contract, then that just gets treated as... you know, an update to your EAR. So under the FASB's proposals, you would also not have to do the 10% test that they require under their guidance. You just do the EAR update. But if you make these other changes, which are the ones not required because of the reform, then you still have to do the 10% test, which is similar to what we are saying, in that you still have to assess whether they are substantial or not. So we try to... I think if you compare the two, you get to a similar outcome, but just maybe in a slightly different way because our standards are slightly different.
Okay.
So I think when in asking the question whether you agree with our proposals, we should maybe ask the question without the examples in paragraph 39. Mm-hmm. In the beginning. 23 and 22 and 23. Those examples that are showing what is substantial modifications and what is not substantial. So maybe let's ask the question without the B bullet in the question. So it's on what is a modification, applying the practical expedient to certain modifications that are related to the reform that on an economically equivalent basis, and also then the order in which the modification should be accounted for. Would the board members agree with those recommendations?
Can we take the modification? Can we take little A apart?
Okay, do you want to vote on A?
Separately.
Okay, we can.
Okay, let's start with A then. And then for the rest of the...
C and D.
C and D, yeah? C and D. No, not on...
13.
Okay.
Okay.
13, one absent minor.
I'll go through agenda paper 14B. This paper focuses on modifications to the contractual cash flows or terms in the context of IBOR reform that resulted in derecognition of the existing financial instruments and the accounting implications arising from the recognition of the modified financial instruments as new instruments. Some of the accounting issues discussed in this paper, however, are also relevant to the newly recognized financial instruments that do not necessarily follow the derecognition of the existing financial instruments. There are five topics discussed in this paper, and in analyzing the feedback from stakeholders, the staff has considered what are the current requirements in IFRS 9 relevant to these topics, and secondly, whether any additional guidance is needed to enable entities to apply the requirements in the context of IBOR reform. In all of these five topics, the staff analysis suggests that the current requirements in IFRS 9 provide sufficient guidance to determine the appropriate accounting treatment. Each topic is followed with a question to the board because they relate to different requirements in IFRS 9. Hence, if the board members agree, I'll tee them up separately and then pause after each question for discussion and vote. All right. Okay. So the first topic relates to the accounting for derecognition of a financial instrument and the effect in profit or loss in the context of IBOR reform. Paragraphs 12 to 14 of the paper set out the analysis of the current requirements in IFRS 9, and the staff recommendation is included in paragraph 15 of the paper. So with that, I'll turn attention to page 6, question 1, asking the board whether you agree with the staff recommendation on this topic.
Okay.
The next topic relates to the business model assessment, specifically whether the derecognition of an existing financial asset following a substantial modification affects the assessment of the entity's business model for managing financial assets. The staff analysis on this topic is presented in paragraphs 23 to 28 of the paper. As a result of this analysis, paragraph 29 sets out the staff recommendation for no amendments to be made to IFRS 9. Question 2 on page 10 of the paper asks the board whether you agree with this recommendation.
Sue.
I do agree. I just wanted to flag for anybody who's listening, I think there's another a specific bit of guidance that if somebody had asked me the question, I would have looked at. So I just wanted to mention it, which is there's an example in the basis paragraphs, BC4145, which talks about if you had a sort of one-off event where there's a regulatory change in the risk weighting of assets that caused somebody to rebalance their banking book, that would not be a change in business model because you'd look at it and say that was a sort of a one-off event. I think that's very analogous to this, and so I would have relied on that if I was being asked this question.
Mary?
I think I just lost my dork of the day crown, but I want to make a comment about paragraph 24, and it's back to that communications point. I think we have to be careful I agree with the recommendations in the analysis, it's not that. But I think we have to be careful not to express things as broadly as it is in paragraph 24, that we expect the majority of modifications arising from IBOR reform not expected to result in substantial modifications. I think we expect that IBOR equivalent reforms, you know, will not result in that. And it's just all about tuning expectations from the outset. And I'm being a bit cranky about that, but I think this is an example of the kind of thing that, you know, could make people ask the kind of questions that Tadeo asked just before about, well, it's related to or it was wrapped in or required to be wrapped in.
Okay. And we support staff's recommendation.
topic relates to the SPPI assessment, specifically whether the contractual cash flows of the new financial asset referenced to alternative benchmark rate, which may be an overnight rate, meets the SPPI criteria in IFRS 9. The staff analysis for this topic is included in paragraphs 44 to 48 of the paper. As set out in paragraphs 49 to 50, the staff do not recommend any amendments to the IFRS 9 requirements on this topic, but we do recommend to add an example to IFRS 9 to illustrate the application of the SPPI requirements in the context of IBOR reform. So that brings us to question number 3 on page 17, asking the board whether you agree with these two recommendations.
I'm fine with the recommendations. Just one thing that I thought about when I was looking at this was that I wonder whether there might be some circumstances where, depending on how these new rates get established in particular jurisdictions, the specific requirements in 9 that relate to regulated rates might apply. So paragraph B419E, and that wasn't mentioned, but I think that that could be relevant in some jurisdictions.
Yes, I think in some jurisdictions, but not in all of them. Yeah.
Okay, and we agree with staff's recommendation.
14. Another topic discussed in this paper relates to recognition of expected credit losses, ECL for short, specifically in circumstances when the entity recognized lifetime expected credit losses for the existing financial asset, whether in those circumstances the loss allowance upon initial recognition of the modified financial asset should be recognized at 12-month expected credit losses, despite there being no changes in the associated credit risk. So the staff analysis on this topic is included in paragraphs 58 to 61 of the paper, and the staff recommendation is set out in paragraph 62. Question 4 on page 20 asks the board whether you agree with this recommendation.
Bored listening to myself. I do agree with this, and thank God it works, because we spent a lot of time thinking about this when we drafted the standard. I think people are asking this question because they're like, do you really mean that things can go back to stage one? And the answer is yes, if there is, you know, a substantial modification that causes derecognition. The only thing that did make me hesitate just slightly when I read the analysis in the paper was the reference to pricing, because I'm not sure that would have been exactly how I would have gone about it, because I think you're right that you can have an instrument which gets modified and derecognized, and you can have it recognized as a credit-impaired loan on its initial recognition. The Greek debt was the reason why we put this in, following the Interpretation Committee discussion. But I think you need to look at whether it's an incurred loss loan, which isn't really per se about the pricing. So I think we just need to be careful not to imply that whether it's priced correctly or not is sort of determinative. And I don't think that's what you meant, but I just worried people might overread what is written here.
Yeah.
And I think really the pricing is relevant to the fair value on initial recognition. So if it's mispriced, then you may not be able to recognise it at its face value. But I don't think it in itself would determine whether or not it's credit impaired. And I don't think that's what you mean, but I think that there's a risk people might think that's what we meant.
Okay, do we agree with the recommendation?
14. The final topic discussed in this paper relates to accounting for embedded derivatives for financial liabilities in accordance with IFRS 9 in a financial instrument contract that contemplates IBOR reform by way of a fallback provision. The staff analysis on this topic is included in paragraphs 67 to 70 of the paper, and the staff recommendation is set out in paragraph 71. Question 5 in page 23 asks the board whether you agree with this staff recommendation.
Is that the case?
14.
Okay. Let's take a break till 11.